Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
For a long time, I was not aware that I lived on a narrow ledge on top of a very high wall. I thought mistakenly that I lived on an endless flat canvas and that I was illustrating and adding color where I wanted, creating my own design. But a wind that began very far away, I don't know when or where, was blowing toward me, invisible and unprovoked. Pray, live well or not, sin, whatever. It's indifferent. Nothing that I did or thought created it. The wind did not exist because of me, and one day it arrived where I was. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Daniel P. Shapiro, author of the heartfelt memoir, The Thin Ledge, a husband's memoir of love, trauma, and unexpected circumstances. In his preface to the book, Daniel writes that he wanted to publish his memoir for many reasons, mostly because he hopes it will be useful to those who are faced with a similar situation. His wife, after two brain bleeds caused by a venous malformation, was fundamentally damaged. But she continued to live for many years, needing constant care and attention. Writing this memoir while raising three young children and working in a demanding profession helped him survive. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Glee. Thank you for having me here.
I usually ask authors how they came to write the book we're about to discuss, but I know you started journaling when your wife experienced that first brain bleed. Can you say more about how you decided to write and publish your most personal thoughts as a memoir?
Sure. I was living an experience that was, I found, very challenging and extreme. And I thought that the best way, actually, I thought is probably not the right way to characterize it. I wound up using writing, which I've always gravitated to and I've always done professionally as a lawyer. I used writing to help me gather up and try to understand the experiences that I was having. I wasn't writing for publication or to share with anybody, actually. It was more of a way to put down as just this torrent of thoughts and challenges and emotions and maybe give them some more careful thought and reflection and maybe organize my thinking a little bit. And over time, it came to be something bigger than that, but I didn't anticipate it as a book when I started writing. It was more of an exercise for me and for my mental health and just as a way of living my life.
You didn't hold back, even when you weren't proud of how you were responding to what was happening. Can you say more about how you felt about your own responses to the situation?
Well, sure. I mean, I think some of the responses were good and some of the responses were not. And when I say good, I mean, some of my behavior over this, you know, 15 plus year time period, I am quite proud of. I love the relationship that grew out of these experiences that I now have with my children, for example. And then there were other things that I did along the way that were, that I'm not proud of, that were human. I don't punish myself for them, but I certainly, when I look at them then and now, they're a little too human maybe. And, you know, everybody is a little bit fallen, and for sure I'm in that category. And so I tried to capture all of it so that it would be useful to me and ultimately authentic, and useful to other people. One of the things that I found in going through the experience that I did is that there really were not a lot of things written out there that I could find that were real honest treatments of what this human experience was. There's a Joan Didion book that got sort of close, but she really wasn't writing about the same thing. And so that really wasn't quite on the mark. And I thought, I'll just sit down and write what's happening and write how I'm feeling and what I'm doing. And let's see where it goes.
Every single reader is probably going to feel the same jolt in their heart that I did when reading about how much you loved your wife and how it felt not to be able to do anything while she was hooked up with tubes. So my question is, if you could reach across time and give yourself advice, what would it be?
Well, that's a tough one. I think that I would suspend judgment. You know, part of what I write about and part of what I lived was what happens to your value system and your moral compass when you're really stretched by circumstances. How do you deal with that? And I think there is a sort of a natural tendency to judge your conduct, which I think we all do, through your own moral lens. And that doesn't fit very well all the time when you are in an extreme circumstance. And so what I would say is, and what I discuss in the book, I think pretty extensively, is do your best, keep your wits about you, but don't judge yourself so much as you're doing your best. Sometimes you'll fail, and you have to be able to, if you're going to survive something really tough, you have to be able to experience the failures and move forward.
Good advice. You write that you didn't realize that you'd missed signs and clues that the doctors didn't expect Susan to live after her brain began malfunctioning. Why didn't you believe when the doctors told you that she wasn't conscious and didn't experience what was happening to her?
I think what happened to me was that my ability to absorb information and understand it maxed out, and I wasn't able to effectively do that when the news got too difficult for me to manage. And so what I learned, it was really interesting and distressing at the same time, and that is there are limits to what at least I am able to absorb and understand. And you can be in a circumstance, you can be in an experience that exceeds your capacity to be a critical thinker, and you just become one of the pieces on the board that are moving around, but your skills that you usually rely on, that I rely on to comprehend and process and think analytically, I found that there's certain times they just left me. They weren't available. I couldn't use them. They weren't there. And That was something I had not experienced before, and it was distressing and interesting.
Mm. I was fascinated by how you reacted to the friend who asked if the doctors had discussed turning Susan's ventilator off. You wrote, quote, "In that instant, she made herself irrelevant. I spent no further thought or feeling in her direction. I said something polite but distant, and she knew that she had stepped outside and I had closed and locked the door behind her." That was about as, that was pretty strong language. Can you say more?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that this brought out for me was seeing the way not only I responded to a difficult, really unhappy circumstance, but to see how other people around me did. And they get to know you because they see what you're doing and how you're responding. And you get to know them because you see how they're supporting you or not, supporting Susan or not. Just sort of what, I mean, maybe it is what one facet of what people call character. And you, I think you get to know somebody better when you're sort of struggling through something hard. And that was a moment when I got to know somebody a little bit better than I did. Not, by the way, not in a negative way. I think, the way I have always thought about that person didn't change for the worse because of that experience. I mean, I think she was being empathetic and trying to be thoughtful and caring. And I just wasn't able to accommodate what she was saying because I didn't have the emotional energy to do it. It didn't make her wrong by any means. And I didn't judge her harshly for it. I just couldn't listen.
Wow. I thought that meant you closed the door on her, not my friend anymore, kind of a thing.
So. No, in fact, she's still a friend. I closed the door on her in terms of her being input for me to manage what was happening in that moment. I couldn't listen to what she was saying.
Uh-huh. I remember being shocked and irritated by some of the responses I got from people after I was diagnosed with cancer. And people asked invasive questions or gave suggestions for, changing my diet or taking supplement, whatever, none of which had any scientific validity. You don't mention it a lot, but did it happen?
If it did, I don't remember it. I don't think it was all that important to me. And I think that unlike cancer, which is, thank goodness I've never experienced, and I'm sorry that you have, unlike that, it isn't what happened to Susan and what we were going through wasn't a common thing. I mean, people didn't really think, well, I've thought about traumatic brain injury when you're 40 years old through a brain hemorrhage. Nobody had thought about that. Nobody had seen it. It's just not a common, at least the people that I knew and spent time with. And so nobody really had anything that they thought through and they had subscribed to as a way of treating it or handling it. So I think what you were exposed to, which I can imagine would be enormously irritating, that was not part of, that wasn't on the menu for me because what I was dealing with was sort of exotic and nobody really, people were just trying to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about how listening to music sometimes helped you get in touch with your feelings, even now, feelings that you had about Susan and then you remember how she was before the brain bleeds?
Yeah, that's a crazy thing. Your questions are terrific because you're sort of diagramming in a way what the emotional experience was. I think what happened was that when I really couldn't access my emotional part because it was just too hard, I think what I found is that I just couldn't turn that on and off when I wanted to. So I built walls for myself, I think, and shut the emotional pieces into their own cages in certain parts of my head so that I could function and live my life. And ultimately that didn't even sustain me in the end. But when I wanted to remember or I wanted to get in touch with a feeling, I couldn't just flip a switch and do it. And so what I found, although I'm not sure I've ever explained it this way before, in fact, I'm sure I have not explained it this way before, what I found was that music made that connection for me. It sort of bridged over the barrier that I had created just so I could live day to day. And it would reach me on a different level. It's interesting. I have a little granddaughter, a one-year-old granddaughter, and I was telling my daughter that my granddaughter has this appreciation for music that is innate. I mean, I suppose all kids do. I don't know, but I'm watching my granddaughter and we put music on and she immediately pays attention to it and sort of gets into it and understands the beat, moves her head. And I think music is sort of a magical thing that way. I think it reaches us in a way that sort of nothing else does. And I certainly found that to be true.
What's the top song that brings you back to that year or those days?
Yeah, I think probably the Eagles, people are going to wince at that because the Eagles get banged around by critics. But the truth is that it was either Led Zeppelin or the Eagles, one of them. And I'm not sure I could tell you as I'm sitting here right now, but the Eagles soundtrack is sort of the background for that part of my life, I guess.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Come on. We all loved them back then.
I okay. did.
I loved your description of helping your daughter tame her curly hair during those middle school years. And I wondered how it was to talk to your children about their experience. Also, what are their responses to your publishing this very personal memoir about their mother?
I would not have published this if my kids hadn't read it and given me the go-ahead. I just wouldn't have done it. They were and have been incredibly supportive of the book and of me. And we just have what I think, and I'm not going to apologize for it, even though every father probably thinks the same thing. I think we have a very special bond and relationship that was created by all this adversity. And they read what I wrote, and I think it resonated with them, or at least they were okay with it. I think the other part of your question was, did I talk to my kids, I suppose, as this was going along? And the answer is, about certain pieces of it, yes. I mean, I tried to keep them current about their mother's condition and what was going to happen to the extent we knew. And so I was always very honest with them about that because I didn't want them to be misled or surprised. They had to be emotionally prepared for what was going to show up in their life. And I wanted to make sure that I was doing what I could to give them a chance to prepare. And so we talked about those things. The rest of it is a little, to be frank, a little blurry to me. I'm sure we did talk, and there are three kids. They're all three very different. I do talk in the book about each of them and the personalities that I was dealing with and helping to form. And each of them were, I'm sure they were different conversations with all three of them.
Hmm. What about friends and family? Can you talk about how they've reacted to the book?
Really well. I mean, if people are reacting, I'm sure there are people who have read this who don't, and this is going to just sound terrible, but it's just the truth. I'm sure there are people who have read this who don't have glowing things to say about it, but that's not what I'm hearing. So people must have more discretion than that. So everybody thinks this is sort of brutally honest, and that gives it value, and that gives it sort of an earnestness that makes it, if nothing else, sort of an interesting human study or study of a human. And I think that's really, that winds up being something that seems to have an audience. I mean, the comment that I get most often is that people found it gripping and couldn't put it down, literally. That's what people say to me. True or not, that's what they say. And that they really appreciate the writing, that the writing is beautiful is the word that they use to me. And you'll forgive me for having to repeat it, but that's what they're telling me.
It absolutely was absolutely beautiful. And I read it in one sitting and an afternoon. So I agree with all of them. Anyway, we have the wonderful author and editor S.L. Weisenberg in common. You thank her in your acknowledgments. And in fact, she's the friend who told me that I had to read your memoir. Can you say something about how Sandy helped you pull over 20 years of journaling into this gorgeous piece of writing?
Sandy is exactly the kind of person who I find irreplaceable. I mean, she is really smart, really honest, very direct, sort of no nonsense. I think anybody who has the opportunity to have Sandy teach them about writing or edit their work is really quite fortunate. I think she's just a very talented person.
My favorite book of hers is Adventures of Cancer Bitch. I loved it.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, what are you writing about these days? And might there be another book in the near future?
Yeah, I'm working on another book. I don't really have anything more in the memoir category to write, but there is some fiction that I want to write. I find that the whole debate in the country right now about race relations to be fascinating. I don't find it to be quite as honest as it needs to be in order to make progress. And I think fiction may be a way to have a conversation about that, you know, you just can't do in a nonfiction context. So I think exploring the way that human beings are actually dealing and have actually dealt with these difficult social issues, I think that will be interesting, and that's what I'm writing about.
I'm just wondering if it's also set in Chicago.
It is. It's set in Chicago. And I find that having spent almost 40 years in law firms, that law firms are particularly, well, not maybe not particularly, but certainly among the institutions in our community where there is a lot of power really challenged by dealing with race issues. All the issues that are on the table right now play out in law firms in a way that have been dealt with, I think it's fair to say, with very mixed success. And not for lack of trying, not for lack of good intentions and a lot of sincere people, but it's just very challenging. And I think all of it is sort of grist for the mill. I think it's pretty interesting stuff to explore.
I am going to look forward to hearing about it when it comes out. Thank you so much, Daniel Shapiro, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with author Daniel P. Shapiro about his memoir, The Thin Ledge, a husband's memoir of love, trauma, and unexpected circumstances. Hope you're all able to lose yourself in a good book today, and tomorrow too. Happy reading.